WRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward.
And we hope you're coming with us.
PRN.FM, bringing you new shows and fresh ideas every day. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live from our studios in New York City. I'd like to welcome you. Today, we're going to have an inordinate amount of time compared to what we normally would for a guest. And that's because I want this audience to know the truth about our foreign policy and what happens when people who are mainly inspired by the prophets of war convince the media, pundits, and the talking heads that you see on all the different networks that we need a regime change. And it's always for protecting the citizens, imploring democracy, but in reality, it's not. And I'm going to give just one example today, and that'll be Libya, from people that actually, Americans who lived in Libya prior to the invasion and destruction of the country. So you're going to hear voices you have not heard, a perspective that does not exist anywhere in American media. And this will give pause to those who have been, I would say, victims of a propaganda war. Because before there's a hot war with weapons, there's a hotter war for our mind and our perception. Control a person's perception, you control the reality. So that's going to happen a little later. Also today, if time permits, we're looking at interviewing an individual who is an expert on Antarctica. And I want to do just a brief newsmaker on what it means when an iceberg the size of Delaware breaks off. How quickly then could the rest of the ice that was being held in check calve and break off and fall into the sea of the Antarctic and therefore raise ocean levels? So these are real events happening. But we're going to begin our program today not with the normal health and nutrition, but something that is far more important. In fact, it's important to everyone listening, about our health care. I was opponent of Obamacare. And I've explained the reasons why. Because it was not written for the benefit of the consumer. It was written exclusively by lobbyists and lawyers for the insurance industry, the hospital industry, and the pharmaceutical industry. I was opposed to Hillary Clinton's health initiative to create a new health program, and for the same reasons. 450-plus advisors, all in secret, we would uncover who those people were, and we got a lot of physicians on our side and their patients. As a result, we were able to defeat it as well. And by the way, that particular bill was so egregious, if you used alternative methods, if you were a board-certified Harvard graduate, which was actually the case with Dr. Carl Humiston, and you practiced homeopathy and you healed your patient, you could go to jail for each patient you healed for 5 years and 3 years and be fined $5,000 per patient. So they wanted to wipe out all alternative medicine completely. So I'm opposed to all health care today, unless it's universal. What we are not asking is far more important than what we are. Now we're asking, well, how high will my premium be? And how much is my copay? And what systems will I be excluded? Will I be able to see the same physician I've been seeing? What we're not asking, does it work? You would think in a society of some 330 million people with a lot of college graduates that we would have the basics first, and we don't. So the first thing to ask is this: what constitutes ideal health care? Well, then we have to look at prevention. Right now, we apply $0, no effort, no commercials or public service announcements to how do we stay healthy. As a result of that, we have reaped the unfortunate moniker of being the fattest nation in the world per population. In fact, we have more overweight and obese people in the United States per population than either India or China. Now, you put those two countries together, you're dealing with 2.5 billion people. So we're the little runt, and yet we're grossly sicker. We do not have the best life expectancy. Children born in the United States in the first year of life have a greater chance of dying than in 39 other developed nations. We spend more on health care, but it's nothing with health in that care. It's all about sickness. So our system has failed. How bad is it? I have personal knowledge on this because it was 10 years ago that I was flying back and I was doing some analysis from orthodox medicine like American College of Surgeons, the American College of Neurology, and I wanted to see how many people are made ill or die because of regular given therapy. And I thought I'd made mistakes, so I enlisted an oncologist and a professor and a research scientist, and that person verified my facts. I then assembled a team. All told, there were five of us, four MDs and myself as a PhD in public health science. And we went to work, and it took us years to assemble all the materials. And what we found was using only orthodox science and medicine's own statistics that the number one cause of death in the United States year in and year out for decades was what you can call medically induced or iatrogenesis, medically induced illness. Now, that does not mean, and I do not want to give the impression that the doctors who were responsible for this were in any way intending to cause a negative outcome. They weren't. I believe that the vast majority of physicians sincerely want to see their patients get well. It's a noble profession, and most of the young people going in are highly idealistic. But be that as it may, the consequences of using the wrong models for treating people, diagnosing, was being used. Why? The responsibility had to be laid exclusively at the feet of the pharmaceutical industry and the for-profit medical industrial complex. So as a result, if you had arthritis, instead of using diet and exercise to properly control or eliminate the inflammatory markers that are causing the arthritis and the cytokine rush that causes the pain, swelling, instead they were given non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Just one of those, Vioxx, killed between 60,000 to 500,000 people. Later research put the number closer to 500,000. I tend to accept that as better research. But let's just be conservative. Let's take the least number that we could find, 60,000. That's still 2,000 more than died in the Vietnam War. So in a short four-year period, one drug for one condition killed 60,000 Americans. But the company, after paying all legal expenses and all fines, still was left with about $14 billion net profit. So for them, the money they had to lay out was just the cost of doing business. So I could take every single specialty and show you similar outcomes. Billions, tens of billions made, money paid out. And then I decided to do additional research. I hired two lawyers, and for a year, all they did every day was collect every lawsuit that was brought by citizens or class action suits against pharmaceutical industry. There were hundreds of thousands of these suits with damages in the tens of billions of dollars. Now, normally, if you or I were found guilty of fraud or price fixing, like Martha Stewart, forever we would be monikered with a idea that we were a criminal, an ex-con. And yet we have a double standard. When major corporations are found guilty, repeatedly found guilty, 1,000 times found guilty, of breaking the law, committing a crime, there is nothing that tarnishes their reputation, the value of their stock. And to the contrary, once they pay these fines, then everybody is happy on Wall Street because that's behind them and they go forward. So you understand, good journalism by any of the mainstream media would have uncovered this and exposed it. No one dared uncover it nor expose it. They might write an article about a particular drug that was found toxic, and they had to pay a fine, and that was it, and the story would be over. But the whole industry is corrupt. The whole system has failed. And that is why we have no prevention. Women are actually losing years off their life expectancy, and the rate of women having heart attacks and strokes is increasing dramatically. Breast cancer is increasing, not decreasing. And the only achievements in healthcare are those where people have begun to make lifestyle modification choices. Therefore, it is not drugs, it is not medical procedures, with the exception of emergency medicine, which I've stated many times is exemplary and should be used. But that's only a small fraction of all of medicine. So when women start changing their diet and exercising, dealing with stress, and stopping unhealthy habits, their breast cancer risk rate goes way down. Medicine has taken advantage and tried to say they were responsible for it. They had nothing to do with it. Medicine has zero, I repeat, zero to do with anything involving health. These people are functional illiterates when it comes to life, spiritual issues, helping the dynamic of a person in the crisis that is manifesting in a disease. Zero. They're very knowledgeable about pharmacology, but unfortunately that has little to do with actually reversing disease. Therefore, I advocate one system only, and that is universal care. I'm going to go through this and just give you the numbers and why it would be a much better system for everyone. First off, this year, minimally, we're going to spend $3.3 trillion, but more likely $3.5 trillion. Now, people's head exploded, and they were very angry, at least those who were progressive or those who were anti-militaristic, when they found out we were spending over $1 trillion on and off book items on the military-industrial complex. Well, this is 300% of that. So how could we save money and change the course of medicine? First, we could make all medical education free. As long as a doctor agreed to work within the system, their entire medical education would be paid for. Hence, they would not have the burden of debt for years afterwards, which could be tempting to start doing excess testing or joining practices that were particularly lucrative because of the high cost of that particular specialty. So let's just say that we started every doctor right out of internship and residency at the normal rate of, let's say, $200,000 a year in salary. Do not put them into debt, but here's the payback. We also do not allow any of them to be sued. We have, just like with no-fault car insurance, we have no-fault medical practice, meaning they don't have to pay medical bills or lawyers or risk losing their practice because of some legitimate or, you know, fraudulent litigation. Now, if we did that and we included in a person's capacity to choose medicine natural and alternative therapies like chelation and intravenous vitamin drips and homeopathy and also psychoanalysis and chiropractic and acupuncture and herbal therapies, those that have been shown by the scientific literature to be beneficial would be used. So then when a person went to a physician, they would actually have some options. And these other physicians who now generally don't take a patient unless you pay cash would be able to be under this protocol. And there are a little over 2,000 up in the United States where there are 920,000 regular doctors. So your whole field would open up. And because you take away the whole malpractice get rich quick for those who are scheming, those who are legitimately injured, there would be a fund set aside that would pay for the legitimate rehabilitation of that person, or if they cannot get back to work, would pay them what they would have made in the normal course of their work. Now, if we got rid of the insurance industry with universal health care, here is what we would save. These are actual figures. All right, and for example, from the Journal of Healthcare Finance, just on medical errors alone, just the errors in medicine, $19.5 billion. And then you look at the Medicaid fraud, that's $272 billion a year in swindles. In the National Review, the government spent $574 million to recover $9 billion in federal civil health care fraud. The insurance industry is the one that makes all the money. For example, United Health, the CEO, made $46 billion, and Aetna, CEO, made $27 million in compensation. And also, I'll give you an example of how bad it is when we're, this is from the CNBC report, there's $275 billion a year wasted in insurance paperwork. That's wasted, $275 billion. For example, $70 billion to physicians, $74 billion to hospitals, $94 billion in service providing health care and supplies, $198 billion in private insurers, $35 billion in public insurers. We also have these figures. If we eliminated the profit made by all of the and expenses by all the administrators of the system. And by the way, when they charge us, they're charging us for their bonuses, their salaries, the private jets that the companies use, the big offices, every single thing they can charge you for, they charge you. We, the people, are paying that. That would save us. Now, if you got a pencil and paper computer, $1.09 trillion a year. Medical errors, if we didn't have these by having proper science, independent science, so the only medicine that would allow to be used is medicine that is backed up by independently verified science, not corporate science, $19.5 billion. Medical fraud, $292 billion. Medical liability insurance, $55.6 billion. Defensive medicine, this means where the physician is having to be highly conservative and over-check you, $45.6 billion. Then the drug industry, $375 billion is what they made last year. But what is the actual amount that would be a legitimate profit? Because now they're gouging. And that's because they made sure that in the Medicare B rider at 2 o'clock in the morning, the day it was passed, heavy group of lobbyists, all of whom went to work for the pharmaceutical industry and quit Congress shortly thereafter, put in the middle of it that the government cannot negotiate on Medicare and Medicaid and psychiatric medications, which is a big bunch. They're making $375 billion. Let them make $100 billion. $100 billion is a lot of profit, and that saves us $275 billion. How much do we spend on unnecessary medical testing? Recently, for example, when I had my annual physical, I had my blood work up done for checking for everything. I had a cardiovascular stress test, echocardiogram, had everything done. I then found that I had to go to another place because they wanted to take another look. And I said, why? Show me what's wrong with that. Well, we just want to be on the safe side. I said, no, show me what's wrong with it. And then someone says, well, we do this all the time. And I wanted to see what was involved. So I went for the test. And the other doctor said, why are you here? He says, take a look. And we're watching my electrocardiogram. He says, it's perfect. And I said, well, this was, I guess, another $1,500 they could squeeze. He said, this is outrageous. I'm going to protest this. So I didn't have to pay it. But I wanted to see how corrupt the system is. It is corrupt from head to toe. And that's $200 billion a year that you're getting an unnecessary medical test done. So let's add all this up. And what does it come to? Here's how much it comes to, $868 billion for all the ones I just mentioned, plus $1.09 trillion, that's $1.958 billion we could save. That means our existing medical bill would be a little over $1 trillion. So it's paid for itself because right now, a high percentage of our tax dollars goes to pay for our medical expenses. So if we're using only those medical procedures that are proven safe and effective and exclude all the other corporate high-profit ones, if we don't over-test people, if we don't over-medicate people, if we don't overstress doctors, if we're taking away the ability to sue them individually and still be compensated if it's a legitimate issue, then we're saving more money than what it actually cost to pay for the system. Hence, it is self-paying. But go one step further. I believe that as a country, all progressives, conservatives and liberals together, should lobby to have a 1%, that's very small, 1% tax daily on money made in the stock market. That's including algorithm sales and all other trades. And to give you an example how much that would be, just in one day on the New York Stock Exchange, they trade $169 billion. That's in 24 hours. So you put all this together, you're dealing with about somewhere in the neighborhood of $250 billion a day. So imagine if we were able to tax people for that at a small amount, then we would have extra money set aside as well. So universal health care, I have the numbers, I've done the research, I know what's wrong with our existing system, and all these other systems like Obamacare or anything that the alchemy of the Republicans, it does not help the average person. It is not meant to. It's purely a for-profit driven system. This is the only reasonable way. And if anyone wants my information, I'm willing to testify before Congress with all my facts, and I can assure you I am far more aware and educated than any single member of Congress or the White House on these issues. They're looking in the wrong direction. They're functionally illiterate on this subject. So let us now bring some adults into the room who know what they're talking about, have the evidence, show them what's wrong with our existing medical paradigm and how to make it right. And I have 2,000 people in the medical field who would be there as supporting witnesses and testimony givers as well. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go over now to speak with our guest who's standing by, Professor Eric Reneau. He is an outstanding scientist, academic, has published numerous scientific papers on the impact of the Antarctic. Nice to have you with us today, sir.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
We are all concerned of what happens when a giant iceberg, approximately the size of Delaware, breaks off the Larsen Sea Shelf and starts to float away. We know that that's not going to increase the ocean's water, but what's behind it, what it was holding back, all that other ice and snow on the glacier, now has an unimpeded process as it warms to calve into the water. Could you give us your understanding, as you're one of the most insightful persons in the world on this topic, of what we can reasonably expect and over what period of time, and what might this do to destabilize other parts of Antarctica? The forum is yours.
Yes, Gary. So this iceberg detached from a floating extension of the glaciers, which we call an ice shelf. So it's land ice that reached the ocean, and instead of breaking up right away, extends over the ocean and forms a floating platforms that eventually breaks up into pieces that we call icebergs. These floating extensions act like a plug on the glaciers. So once the plug is removed from climate warming, for instance, then the glaciers can spill out much more ice in the ocean than they used to and thereby raise sea level. The calving that we just witnessed was a record calving for Larsen C, and the sign that the ice shelf was no longer healthy and was starting to break up. But there's still a fairly large fraction of the ice shelf left, and the glaciers have not really felt the effect of the big piece that that detached. We need to see more detachment from that ice shelf before the glacier start to feel the effect. We also know that if the ice front of that floating extension starts to break up even more, another 20 kilometer, there's a risk that the whole rest of it is going to fall apart in a domino-like effect, just like we've seen farther north on Larsen B in 2002. At that point, the glaciers will definitely feel that the plug has been removed, and they will speed up in the ocean and contribute to sea level.
How much ice are we talking about?
Not so much ice. We estimate that there's an equivalent of 1 centimeter, half an inch, global sea level rise potential held by Larsen C. For Larsen B, which was farther north, which collapsed in 2002, the sea level equivalent was 4 millimeters. But what's important to understand here is that this is giving us a proxy as to what may happen farther south as climate warming proceeds over the Antarctic continent and starts breaking up ice shelves holding bigger glaciers with larger potential sea level rise.
Does it concern you that virtually all the predictions made in the past have been far short of accurate when it comes to the potential for cascading or speeded up glacier melting?
Yes, it concerns me, and the reason for that is that the largest unknown in projecting sea level rise in the future is how much the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are going to contribute, and they're not going to contribute by just melting at the top from warmer air temperature. They're going to contribute because the glaciers, these big rivers of ice that control the flow of ice from the continent into the ocean, may start to speed up. As an example, in the wake of the collapse of Larsen B in 2002, when we were trying to figure out how much the glaciers will speed up in response to the ice shelf removal, the numbers went way higher than what we expected. The glaciers sped up by a factor 3 to 8, and they're still flowing about 3 to 5 times faster now than they used to do in the past. So to put these numbers in perspective, if all the glaciers around the Antarctic continent were to speed up by a factor 7, which is possible in the wake of what we saw on Larsen B, we would raise sea level by 4 meters per century, which of course would be catastrophic. But it's possible to see such magnitude changes on the glaciers. And that's the big unknown, and that factor has not been fully accounted in projection of sea level rise used so far by physical models.
There is one other thing I'd like to ask you, and that is that for 15 years I had a home. I lived on South Beach mm-hmm. on the water across the street from the ocean. And I remember one day while running up the beach, as I would normally do a 10-mile run in the morning, I saw that the seaweed was being left after the high tide went out further and further. So I began to take notice of this. And over the next 12 months, I saw that the seaweed was getting closer and closer and closer to the street. So I spoke with several people And I also spoke with someone who was putting new sand down on the beach every morning. I hadn't seen that before. Truckloads, barges of sand and bulldozers, long before the public would come out, so that the reason people go to Miami Beach is because of the beach. Wonderful beach. And I asked some brokers, a broker friend of mine, I said, are you concerned about the fact that irrespective of the category storms, just every night when the water comes in with a high tide, it's coming further, further in. You're getting a surge. And the person said, I don't talk about it. I can't talk about it because if I did, people might not buy here. It's not in my interest to talk about what the future is, but I'm sure nothing will happen for the next 10, 20 years. Just 2 years later, when I went over one night to what is the main road that goes, there's only about 8 or 9 blocks wide, that's all it is, a little sliver of land, but one of them is called Alton Road, and it's what connects to the most popular place probably in the United States per street, and it's called Lincoln Road, where all the cafes and restaurants and theaters are, and it was filled with water, 18 inches. I thought that was a water main break. Turns out that every single night it was flooded.
Yeah.
And then I found out that that's how bad it was, and that's water that they had no capacity to get out under their normal drainage system. They had to put $225 million in turbines in there to take water from that had come in from the Atlantic, dump it in the bay, which went right around to the Atlantic. I'm thinking, whoa, no one's paying attention to this. It wasn't in the newspapers, the Miami Herald. No one wants to talk about this because it would cause property values to collapse. It would cause the real estate taxes to collapse. And so in time, I sold and got out, and now it's even worse than ever. And we're seeing this also down through the Keys. Do we have an honest capacity to have a realistic and not an ultra-conservative discussion in our media about the likely impacts of just the nighttime waves coming in all up and down the coast of the United States? Sir, did you hear my final comment?
Yeah, and I'm familiar with the situation. I went to Miami Beach for an educational workshop led by Vice President Al Gore, and they set up the workshop in September during the high tide period. And it's quite common during that time to have a number of streets completely flooded by seawater. It's an interesting experience because you see quite a bit of water in the street, and naturally you would expect that this water will evaporate over the next few days. It's just rainfall, but you realize after a few days that that water is not going to go away, and some streets are completely blocked. They're using, as you mentioned, giant turbines to pump the water out of the streets and free it from the water. These pumps, in principle, are supposed to be used for high tides, but in certain parts of Miami Beach, they run these pumps 24 hours a day. So Miami Beach is a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of facing the consequences of sea level rise. And for a lot of us, we are not prepared for this. Even psychologically, we're not prepared to seeing seawater flooding the coastlines and filling up the houses along the coast. It's something that doesn't seem possible. Yet our job as scientists is to tell people, well, we know sea level is rising. It's rising faster and faster, and we can tell you for sure that down the line, the melting of land ice will be even greater than it is today, so sea level will rise even faster. So it's time to think very seriously about adaptation for what's going to happen in the next 4 years, but also to think in terms of mitigation, in terms of what should we do to avoid the worst-case scenarios down the line, the worst-case land ice melt. Because once that sort of process is launched, you cannot stop it. It's not like a bathtub overflowing and wetting the floor of your house, and then you just close up the tap. You won't be able to close the tap for another 40 years or century even. So it's important for our audience to take a perspective on this. This is sort of a slow rise in sea level, but there are gigantic forces behind it that make it such that if you want to slow down the process or even stop it, you're going to have to work very hard on it. It's possible to do it, but it's going to take a lot of work.
Let us invite you back for that discussion on what it's going to take and how we can do it. But that is going to be a longer one-hour conversation. I thank you for being on our Newsmaker today and sharing your insights with us.
You're welcome, Gary.
Professor Eric Renault, that's R-I-G-N-O-T. And by the way, to give you an idea who this gentleman is, he is Chancellor, Professor of Earth Systems Science at the University of California at Irvine School of Physical Sciences and the Principal Scientist for the Radar Science and Engineering Section of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And he specializes in the mass balance of the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets and the interaction between ice shelves and ocean systems and ice sheets modeling. And he's just simply one of the most respected climatologists in the world. And he holds multiple degrees, doctorates from University of Southern California in engineering and also from astrophysics and also astrospace engineering from University of Paris, also University of California, respectively. We will have him back when we have more information. And we are the station on the entire planet that gives you more information on environmental issues than anywhere else. Now let's go over, and before we go to our principal guests who are standing by, let's go over, because we always like on a Friday to say hello to someone who has made major changes when medicine had no answer. And I believe that we have on the line right now Jessica with Lou Anne Panessi. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Jessica, tell us briefly the medical condition that you had that medicine was not able to help you with.
Sure. So about 2.5 years ago, at the age of 22, I started having symptoms of intense abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting, which could last up to 5 days straight. And it would just have me completely bedridden and useless. And then it eventually had gotten so bad that I had to take on disability from work. So I was just left with watching my body slowly deteriorate and my life kind of just slip away from me. And all the while, I had doctors and specialists telling me that there's nothing wrong. They couldn't find anything wrong with all the tests that they had done. And they had diagnosed me with some things called cyclical vomiting syndrome or abdominal migraines, all of which are not curable, and they have no effective treatments. So it was a very frustrating process, which was leaving me kind of hopeless. And I would tell myself for years, you know, if I could just figure out exactly what the problem is, then I can fix it and I would do whatever it takes. So that's when my mom told me about Lou Anne. So she's been following Lou Anne and Gary in their holistic approach for healing for many years now. And I was able to meet with Lou Anne. She took one look at me and my symptoms and just knew exactly what to do for me.
So and how are you? More relieved. How are you today? Do you have the medical condition today?
Today, I am feeling much better, and I do not. Things are very good. It's even from 5 months after having seen Lou Anne, I was able to get back to working full time again.
And do you have 5 days in a row now or 1 day in a row where you vomit?
No, none at all. Absolutely none. No more stomach pain, no more nausea or vomiting.
So were any of these experts and doctors and specialists who said that there was nothing medicine could do and they didn't understand it, have any of them asked you what you did?
Has the doctors ever asked me?
Yeah.
No, not really, no.
Okay. Well, that tells us all we need to know. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing. I'm very happy to see that you're doing great. And Lou Anne, for people who are wanting to come to our upcoming October retreat, which is a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI in New York, which we love and want to see continue, and we're using the money to pay for premiums. Give us your number, please.
Surely. It's 903-881-7008. That's 903-881-7008. 0-8.
Thank you, Luann. And thank you, Jessica.
Okay.
And every week, we will bring on someone who has reversed a terminal condition or medically irreversible condition who is today happy and well. And they'll say it can't be done. And just remember, they said Bannister and no one else could ever break the four-minute mile until he did. And shortly thereafter, 10 other people did as well. What was holding them back? Belief. Now let's go to our guests who are sending by. And it's interesting to speak. I'm sure you're going to hear a lot of insights that you would not have known otherwise about Libya. And my guests standing by down in Texas are James and Joanne Moriarty. They were living in Libya from 2007 until the overthrow and death of General Gaddafi. Nice to have you both with us today.
Good morning, Gary. Great to be back on your show.
Good morning, Gary.
Okay. All right. I'm going to ask you for some short answers here. First and foremost, tell us what life was like for the average person living in Libya before NATO, Hillary Clinton, and the Nobel Peace Prize winning President Barack Obama decided to destroy the country.
The country had no debt. They only used about 49% of their income to support all the government activities. The rest of it was participated out in benefits to the people. In 2011, there were 620,000 new condominiums being built for the people. And the way you bought your home is you paid 10% of your salary for 20 years, and then it was yours. And in that period of time and thereafter, utilities were free. Your first automobile cost you half a dealer invoice. When you got married, the government gifted you $46,000. Each new birth, the government gifted you $5,000. Every Christmas season, which is their Eid, the government gave every man, woman, and child a $500 gift. You just went to the bank and picked it up. And if you were a poor businessman or you had lost your money or whatever, the government had storehouses all over the country. And you could go up there without any ID or anything and tell them you needed food, and they'd give you 50 kilos of rice and 50 kilos of flour and powdered milk and cheese and enough money to go have an animal slaughtered for yourself. And if you went back the next day, they'd do it again. Education was free, and if your brain would support it, then the government would pay for you to be educated outside of Libya, and they gave you a living stipend. Young man we knew was getting his doctorate in England. He had a wife and four kids. His monthly stipend was 4,500 pounds a year at that time. That was a month. Wow. That was about $7,500 a month living expenses on top of all his schooling being paid, free hospitalization, free drugs. If you needed to go outside of Libya again, the government paid all your expenses plus paid your travel and living expenses for you and a family member to go have your medical treatment done someplace else. They did not like radicals at all, did not support them, weren't even allowed. If you had a beard and a mustache, you would barely be hired, and then you would not be elevated in any business there. So they were not, under any circumstances, radical. In fact, Gaddafi had disclaimed the addition to the Quran that the Ayatollah Khomeini had written when he was in exile in France. He had rejected that, didn't allow it to be printed or taught in Libya. And for that, the radical Muslims put a murder fatwa out on him that lasted 20 years.
Gaddafi emancipated women in the 70s. Women were not required to wear any special clothing. In fact, he even recommended they don't even wear headscarves. But they were doctors and lawyers and entrepreneurs and mothers, and they also were a big part of the army. All Gaddafi's guards were women. He had a great respect for women, and he felt their contributions to society was paramount. So there were no restrictions on women in Libya like there are in other Muslim countries.
So what we heard about Libya and Gaddafi just were not true. In fact, in the first week in February of 2011...
Oh, hold on. I'm not finished yet. Okay. I want short answers to these. To the best of your knowledge, I have heard from multiple scholars that Libya had more freedom for women than any other Muslim country in the world, yes or no?
Yes.
That Libya had more women college graduates and doctorates and medical doctors than any other Muslim country in the world, yes or no?
Yes.
That Gaddafi gave, it was actually against the law to insult or in any way violate a woman in Libya, yes or no?
Yes.
That women had the same rights as a man in divorce? She did not have to go to a special court, yes or no?
Yes.
That women in Libya could own property and the child could inherit the property from the mother, not just the father, yes or no?
Yes.
That Libya had no crime I'm not talking about the terrorists now, the radicals you're talking about were actually the terrorists, but you could walk the streets of any Libyan city without fear of mugging, rape, being up or robbed, yes or no?
Yes.
Libya was considered the most advanced technological, the most advanced in education, the longest lifespan of any country, of the 54 countries in Africa, yes or no?
Yes.
That Libya also had more constitutional provisions in Libya than any country in the history of the world, including way over the United States, and how local citizens had control over the daily lives by constitutional guarantees, yes or no?
Yes.
That in Libya, Gaddafi and his family were the last to get homes, and he lived in a tent until all the other people he promised homes had them. Yes or no?
Yes.
That Libya was like Paris and was considered Paris and had zero debt and had over $20 billion minimally. I've actually heard a figure that's closer to $124 billion in gold reserves. Yes or no?
Yes.
That the real reason that Gaddafi was invaded, not because he was a terrorist, not because he killed any of his people, there's no proof of that whatsoever, but rather because he was inviting other nations in Africa to join in an Arab financial transaction where the gold dinar would be the currency of exchange, not the U.S. dollar for petrodollars. Yes or no?
Yes.
That Libya had made the largest man-made structure in the world, in history, with the largest aquifer to feed not just his own country, but also more than 180 million Africans fresh water from one of the deepest, largest aquifers in the world. Yes or no?
Yes.
So, why isn't it that any reporter from CNN has gone to Libya before this, or the New York Times, or anyone? I don't know anyone who's done this homework to show that Libya was not engaged in any of the things we were told. Now you can answer, why do you believe Libya was attacked?
Well, Gary, the truth is that the media, except for entities like yourself, there's 85 men that own 70% of everything in the world, and their propaganda goes wherever they want. Gaddafi had actually started the African Bank, and the currency was a gold-backed dinar. And all the Arab countries had signed up as members, and half of Africa had signed up as members. And the toilet paper bankers that have nothing behind their money, nothing behind it, would be put out of business if the resources of Africa were put behind a gold-backed currency. Then the Federal Reserve, Euroclear, all the Rothschild, Rockefeller banking system would have collapsed. So that's really why Libya was blown up and taken over. They could not afford to have their empire crash, which it's doing now anyhow.
Okay, I would challenge that assumption for three reasons. One, because if you take a look at the people that you're calling Zionists, in Israel, those who hold to a Zionist, which is not a religious principle but a political principle, there is conflict between their ideology and the ultra-Orthodox who are opposed to that, as well as more the progressive and liberal Jewish people who are opposed to that. And so you have to keep it by regions and not suggest and fall into that trap and touch that third rail that it's worldwide.
Gary, I didn't say anything about the Jews. The Zionists and Jews are not the same thing.
I understand.
Not the same at all. You have to separate.
I, I understand you got to separate and make it very clear. Separately, when we talk about the banks, today we don't need to use the word the Rothschilds, because today the banks are controlled by large groups, let's say large meaning probably under 2,000 people, who have enormous investments and control the outcome of how that money comes in and goes out, and what they use it for, and the creation of debt. So if you say that Gaddafi represented a threat because if he got away, as Saddam Hussein tried before him, by using another exchange rather than the dollar, that's a legitimate argument. I would support that argument. Now I want to go back to another thing here. Tell me the strengths and weaknesses of Gaddafi as a political leader.
Well, they were non-confrontational. That was his biggest weakness. The Khazarian mafia, the Kenites, debt scheme, the Babylonian debt scheme, they moved into Misrata about 150 years ago, and they were really mafia. They absolutely used strong-arm tactics and bullied and everything, and they were the problem in Libya. And the Libyans didn't want to fight about anything, so they let these people get away with everything. And 60% of all the contracts in Libya were let to the Misrata mafia without bid or tender. And they would then turn around and subcontract those out to foreign developers. And they would short pay them. They didn't pay them for expansions and things like that. And then after a while, the foreign developer would leave and abandon the money that was owed to him. And the Misrata mafia would turn around and do it again. And
Gaddafi was not leading Libya at the time of 2011. He was required to step down from leadership in Libya in 2006 with the treaty he signed with Condoleezza Rice, and he did step down.
But, you know, the media is always have to have a boogeyman out there that you can attack, and, of course, they continually attack him. But what I was trying to say earlier, in first week in February of 2011, the U.S. Department of Defense declared Gaddafi the greatest ally the United States had in this war against terrorism. And then 3 weeks later, the media was talking about him being the sorriest SOB that ever drew a breath.
We're aware of that because of WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks actually showed the support that the State Department had for Gaddafi in his fight against terrorism. I need real quick answers because we only have a couple minutes left here, about 4 minutes left. Number one, a lot of migrants came in to work in Libya because it was known as being fair to the workers. They would get good pay, and this was Mali and Algeria. And yet, once this conflict started, and once the terrorist groups invaded into Libya with the full support of the United States and the CIA, they started to kill these people. In fact, in one area, they killed all of they could find. It was over 20,000 people. All told, for 50,000, these people never made it home. And yet they were considered, they were called terrorists, yet they were just migrant workers who would come there, they would live, and they would go home. And yet in the official statistics, none of them were acknowledged to have been killed, and yet as many as 50,000 were killed. Are you aware of that?
Yes, yeah. More than
number,
that.
Numbers much larger than that.
Much larger than that? Okay. I try to take the most conservative figures. Also, we were told that when Condoleezza, no, it wasn't Condoleezza Rice, when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were justifying to the public and the press that was in justifying, they said that in Benghazi, Gaddafi had sent soldiers to and were killing innocent civilians. That is not true. In point of fact, we have three known terrorist groups, all armed and supported by the CIA, who were there and were shooting and killing people. You're aware of that?
Yes. Completely correct.
False flag. Completely.
It was a false flag, and anyone who did their homework would know that. So give us now your conclusions about what the public of the world has been not known about Libya, because they're using the same playbook in Syria, same identical playbook. And they did the same thing in Iraq. And look at the mess of Afghanistan. So what are your conclusions about Libya before and Libya after? What is Libya like today?
It's a failed state. It's complete anarchy, and it's being continually supported. The U.S. continually sends in weapons, arms, and more mercenaries trying to hold on to Libya. And it's really got gangs, armed gangs, like the old West and the United States, that are running over the country. The people of Libya have finally started to be able to fight back because there's so much negative press and the truth about what's going on there. And in Tripoli, for example, the Al-Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, all those guys had really taken control of Tripoli by gun, period. And the young folks in Tripoli had finally had enough of it, being raped and robbed every day. And so they joined hand actually with just an outlaw, a guy that was like Jesse James. And that guy was well-armed, and he was stealing for money, not for political power. They joined hands with him, and those are the people fighting against the U.S.-supported terrorists in Tripoli. So Libyans are fighting back. Now there's been a lot of advances, and there is the luster is falling off of the criminals in Washington, D.C. that keep supporting these terrorists. So the Libyans are hopeful that they will have a chance to finally get their country cleaned
up. The great tribes of Libya are rising up together as they're an 8,000-year-old culture, and they have a leader that they're going to put forth, and that leader will go to a vote once the U.S. and all the Western powers get their mercenaries out of that country, and they intend to completely cleanse their country and take it back.
You know, the U.N. had an election in Libya three or four years ago, and the people voted, and they threw out Muslim Brotherhood almost in toto and all the rest of the terrorist groups, and that was not the vote that the U.N. wanted. So the U.N. has continued to send in new puppet governments, just like Obama and Hillary did in the first days of that. So, you know, the influence of the United States in that conflict it continues daily, and it needs to stop. And the people of the United States need to be informed. You know, the evil empire.
Oh, okay, James, I'm opposed to the death penalty. I don't believe we should ever use words like stringing up. I believe that legitimately you could say that we should have an international criminal tribune, because there is no statute of limitations on crimes against humanity, and look carefully at the actual evidence, prima facie evidence, and the witnesses. You were there. You would be the witnesses also to hold accountable those who have benefited from this and the war machine that benefited, and so that once and for all, at least once in America's history, people committed crimes against humanity would be held accountable. I thank you both, James and Joanna Moriarty, for being on. And you can go to their website, which is LibyanWarTheTruth.com. I'm Gary Knoll. We're here to look past all the smoke and mirrors, the conditioning, the propaganda, find the truth, and then share it with you, something that the mainstream and alternative media refuses to do. Have a nice day, everyone. There's a lot of things I want.